Welcome to another episode of Jabber and the Drone, the podcast who, whose identity might be compromised. How about that?
Half of our identity, half of Cassidy Robinson's identity.
Oh, how do you know, Richard Wally?
Oh, because I introduced you.
How do I know that you're not the one?
That's a good question.
It is. It's a brilliant question.
I do have access to most of your information. You just don't know.
We do this once a week. We're online. It's the net. Sandra Bullock.
I know your security questions. Did you say Sandra Bullock?
Yeah.
I don't know if that has anything to do with it. Go.
Isn't that how this goes? It's like you connect and there's like the wires and the internet and then...
Oh.
And it's like, it's then you're totally exposed to the world.
Wow, that was a really weird reference that I didn't think you'd ever make. I kind of forgot about that movie until right now.
Never doubt my abilities to pull random programmers from 20 years ago out of the blue. Okay, so story. You already know this. You were the first one I told, and so far actually the only person I told, and probably the only one I will tell, until it's all taken care of, except for, you know, our dear listeners. So secret safe, probably. I went to buy some breakfast, lunch, whatever you want to call it, if it's afternoon. And $3 was denied. This happens every once in a while. I've been having problems with my card. So I went and checked the ATM machine. Said my balance was zero. Then I thought, kind of weird. Since I just put over $600 in my account not very long ago. So I drove to my bank. And we were supposed to record this morning, and this is why we didn't. But I drove to my bank. And... found out that I had $325 charges from Iowa all on Saturday when I was here in Pocatello, Idaho, watching Hellraiser movies on Netflix. So that's been my last 16 hours.
Fun for you.
Do you think this is some karmic revenge by the movie deities for not having any interest in seeing or reviewing Identity Thief?
For you specifically, yes. But in general, other people know. Just you.
what
I don't know why I wanted to specify. I was just being mean, I guess. Hateful, I don't know. Why don't you tell them your other news?
What's my other news?
Other news is what... we're not going to be doing today.
Yes. This is a movie podcast, and at the end of the program, we usually do our Netflix homework, which we assign to each other. I couldn't do my homework this week because I was going to watch our Netflix homework earlier today, but instead got stuck in my bank and had to discuss fraud. With the tellers for about an hour or so. I could have watched it over the weekend. I put it off, and of course, when I put everything off to the last minute, something has to ruin the whole endeavor. So the choices were not do an episode at all this week, or we just gloss over that segment and hold the review for Monty Python's meaning of life until next week, which is what we decided to do.
Yep. I just wanted to do a visual, you know, a verbal hand slap on air.
You wanted to reprimand me.
Yes, I did. I feel better now.
I had to get up in front of the classroom and explain myself.
Yep. Now I feel better.
Do you?
Not really.
Do you feel like a big man?
Not normally. I'm only 5'8", so...
It's true, I'm actually taller than you.
Yeah, so. We just paused for no reason.
I was drinking water.
Oh. There was a pause and I got scared. I was like, I should yell something right now.
That was my reason.
Yeah, I don't know why. I've never had that paranoia.
You did something cool this weekend, but I kind of forgot what it was. But I know that it was... Semi-fun.
Me and my wife, we went away for a little, it was basically to this weird little creepy hotel. It used to be a Mason's Lodge. It's called the Grand Lodge. And we got our backs massaged.
Okay.
It was glorious. I've never had that done.
Where was this?
It was in the Grand Lodge.
And this is in Portland?
This is in, it's called Forest Grove. It's like 45 minutes outside of Portland.
Okay.
And we did some Japanese hot tub style thing beforehand, and it was very relaxing. And then we, the next day, drove to Astoria, where we went to the Goonies. Well, it's called the Oregon Film Museum, but it's essentially the Goonies Museum. and we looked at Goonies stuff. And then we went to a big, weird house called the Flavel House and looked at the antiques, and then we left. So we also drove across a big thing my wife called the Death Bridge. She's afraid of bridges since that one collapsed in Washington.
When was
and
that?
And I made her go across it. It's also in Astoria.
When did the bridge collapse?
Like a month or two ago?
Oh, I didn't hear anything about that.
Yeah, it's called in news. It's not about movies, though. It's about, like, stuff that happens in the world.
Like real news? Like people news?
Yeah, like people. When stuff happens to people, yeah.
Didn't make it to Idaho, but...
I don't believe in it usually either, but people kept telling me about it, so...
About the bridge collapsing. So you went film tripping to Astoria where Richard Donner filmed Goonies?
Mm-hmm. Well, we didn't go film tripping. We just went because it's a cool little town and we were going to go to the beach, but it was cloudy, so we went there instead.
Yeah. Did you, like, do the whole bike ride over the little, like, mountain hill thing and, like, through the rocks?
No, that's like a, like, the story is like 30, like, where we went to the beach, you have to go 15 minutes south and Astoria is like 30 minutes north. So a bike ride would be like a day trip. So, no.
So does that movie lie a little bit about the geography?
It does lie a little bit. However, we did see the old Ford RV with the bolt holes.
Oh, they left that?
Yeah, we saw Oswald Cobblepot's...
That's the penguin.
His name's similar, though.
No, I know.
Cobblepot.
No, I know what you're talking about.
It's the dead guy in the cave.
Yeah.
They had his stuff in the little key. And then that whole gel scene at the start, they have, like, the pipe hanging up on the gel, and the sign that says, "You schmuck, do you really think I'd kill myself?" So, and then they had other little tiny artifacts from films. Like, I guess Short Circuit was filmed there, and Ninja Turtles 3, if anybody cares. there was some other things.
Astoria, too. Washington stood in for Japan?
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Well, you know, there's a lot of Asian folk around here, so
I guess was from a casting call or?
I don't know. I have no idea, Cassidy.
I don't either.
About the third Ninja Turtles movie. I don't think I've seen it since I was like 6 or 7.
I always wonder if that one, like, I remember, like, as a kid not loving Ninja Turtles 3, like, even back then kind of being like, I think this franchise has run itself into the wall, but I wonder if it ages better now.
I don't know. But you can't assign it, so.
That's true. Okay, well, we do have a lot of movie news. This, of course, this is the weekend of, or the, you know, the week past the week of Comic-Con. So, movie news has exploded over the last 7 days. And well,
The good thing about Comic-Con news, though, is it's a lot of, sometimes it's almost spoilery, but there's so much of it that you can't really, like, take it all in.
No, yeah, that's true.
So and nothing gets spoiled.
No, I don't know if they really, like, spoil stuff, but it's where you start getting the big reveals. And people start putting their cards on the table. It's kind of silly, because basically, 2 months from now, if there was no Comic-Con, 2 months from now, all of this information would come out on its own. But it's just, Comic-Con gives this platform for buzz.
Yeah.
So, we will aid and abet in said buzz.
Sure.
I guess the big news, the big spanking hot flashy news that everyone's really talking about, I think, is the Batman-Superman team-up movie that's set for 2015.
Actually, you know what? When I heard that news, I was actually happy because I was afraid that they were just going to go straight into Justice League, and that made no sense to me. I was like, okay, this is going to be a horrendous mess. I mean, I think it's going to be a mess a little bit anyways, just because it seems weird to me.
Yeah.
It's always seemed weird to me, like their team, like the Avengers was always a team, whereas the Justice League was like a mash together of all the heroes in one universe. Yes, I know Justice League predates and blah, blah, blah. I don't really care. It's always seemed like you took a bunch of characters and you said, these are random events that would bring all these heroes together. Yeah, I guess so. Or Superman could probably just do it all on his own.
No, that's true. Good Justice League stories have been written.
Sure.
And it's usually the ones where it's more about, like, the internal politics within the group and how that gets compromised rather than some external thing they have to go fight, which can be a little tedious.
Yeah. Or Identity Crisis was good.
Yeah.
Really good.
I mean, Identity Crisis was essentially Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, but with the Justice League.
Yeah. Sure. No, that's true.
And that kind
I never thought about that, but
and that kind of works for the Justice League. Whereas, I don't know. Whereas when you treat them as two-dimensionally as those characters can be, especially when you're juxtaposing them against each other. But yeah, so Batman, Superman, I guess the big question is, what Batman? Because, and who is it, and is it going to be Christian Bale? Is he coming back? He said he has no interest in doing it. I guess we should believe him.
Well, I think
is it going to be?
I know it's a new guy.
Yeah.
They pretty much said that.
So it's not going to be Joseph Gordon-Levitt as John Blake Batman?
No. Nolan's has specifically said that is its own universe.
His universe is closed.
Yeah, his universe is closed and will not be attached to this one. Unless that's some, like, I guess semi-clever lie, but I don't...
Yeah. Gotcha!
Yeah. It's like, okay. Not us, guys, I guess. You just kind of lied to us is all.
You said one thing and did the other. That's fun.
Yeah, I can do that too.
We do it often on this podcast, even.
Yeah, we do.
Well, okay, so if it's not going to be that, is it going... they are probably going to use the Henry Cavill reinterpretation of Superman.
Oh, they are, yes.
And I believe Snyder is attached to the Batman-Superman reboot, or whatever it is, the movie, the team-up.
Evan Goyer and Nolan, I think, are all returning.
Yeah, I think Nolan's involvement is minimal at this point. I think he's just producer.
Right.
Goyer probably will be the writer. I don't know. I mean, it's a big mystery. I do think it is smart to just see if the two work well together in a movie and see what that chemistry's like, and then go forward from there.
Just to make this bomb of a movie where you try to introduce all these characters. I mean, Marvel, what they did is they built it up, you know. We had four 2-hour previews for the Avengers. So we kind of knew, you know, some character development, what was going on.
Yeah, they had built the the framework for what this franchise was going to be, what the ultimate team up was going to be by introducing them in these separate movies. And I mean, it was a crazy model, and it ended up working, and they were able to actually build it up that way. But DC, since all of their different characters are so entangled in so many different studios and different interpretations that are so wildly different.
DC?
Yeah.
DC's all through Warner Brothers.
Is it?
Yeah. They're DC's owned by Warner Brothers.
Okay.
It has been for a lot of years.
But we have...
Sorry, not to be rude.
No, you're right. Yeah, the whole Six Flags and blah, blah, blah. You're correct. But I mean, you wouldn't know that necessarily, like, watching...
Well, I think they're going to try to do it with Green Lantern, but then it sucks so bad, and people generally panned it that, in general, you know.
Yeah.
Well, there wasn't a lot of love for it at all, so I think they kind of had to kind of step back and go, maybe we might have to go at this a different direction.
I read this really funny article recently after the news that was announced that this Batman-Superman thing was happening. And they're getting all geared up for the possible Justice League movie happening, because it was also announced, I should say, in conjunction, that there's a Flash movie that's going to happen in 2016, and then a Justice League movie possibly in 2017, probably depending on how well these other two do. So far, I mean, Superman did pretty well.
Yeah.
And obviously there's a market for Batman. We don't know exactly what he's going to be in this movie, but there you go. But the article was basically stating, like it was comparing each character from Justice League to Avengers and how well their franchises did. Mm-hmm. And it was like saying, like, basically, like, Iron Man was Batman for them. I forget some of the other comparisons, but...
Oh, what a funny article.
But I think, basically, the takeaway from it when I read it was that, basically, Green Lantern's going to be their Hulk. That it didn't do well on its own, but that it could possibly be integrated into the Justice League with a better script surrounding the character.
Hmm. I guess. I mean, no. There was like 15 minutes of cool stuff in that movie, and it all had to do with Ryan Reynolds fighting some weird galactic thing in space.
Sure. But the thing is that, and what I think the article's getting at, was that you don't have to introduce the character anymore. The advertising on that character is taken care of. Everyone knows what he is. Whether or not they liked the movie... Or whether or not the movie itself was good, they don't have to do the legwork of being like, oh, hey, you're Hal Jordan. You used to fly an airplane until you found this magic ring.
I think they should do it like that.
Exactly like that.
Yeah.
They should just break the fourth wall and stare exactly into the camera and just give their backstory.
Well, yeah, like back in the like 80s when they used to like reintroduce the character every like issue.
Yeah.
They'd be like... I'm the meanest SOB there ever was. My name's Wolverine. I have claws, and I can heal fast, and blah, blah, blah. Bub. And then they go into the comic. I think they should do it like that.
Or they could have footnotes. I was talking about this a little while ago with some friends that... you remember when comic books used to include footnotes for if they were making a really obscure reference? They would, like... It was, like, a big thing in the 90s, or possibly, the late 80s, too, but...
They still do it in Hellboy every once in a while.
Well, sometimes you have to, but there would be like, you know, it would show like a character approaching another one and be like, I hope this doesn't go as bad as last time. And I would say, see Amazing Spider-Man issue 233, blah, 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 blah. Like down at the bottom.
Can't wait until they start doing that in movies. Yeah. Just a little blip at the bottom. Skip to chapter 4, second 13.
as you may recall from Captain America, the First Avenger.
Yeah.
It might get that way if they really want to continue with this comic book movie universe. But we'll see if Warner Brothers is able to do it as cleverly as the Marvel Studios. They have we've talked about it ad nauseum, but they have a lot more work to do.
Well, they have a lot more work to do, and their most successful franchise we've already talked about isn't tied into it at all.
Yeah. tonally, their other most successful franchise, Superman, The Man of Steel, is vaguely tied to the franchise they can't use.
Yes.
So we'll see how they're able to do all that.
Moving on to the next big...
Yeah, I'll let you talk about Marvel Age of Ultron, because I don't know what the fuck it is.
What do you mean?
Like, well, you can talk about it, because I don't know what it's a reference to. I don't know why I'm supposed to be excited about it.
Well, basically, Marvel's big...
their big reveal.
Big panel. Basically, they brought on the Captain America cast. Apparently, Tom Hiddleston performed as Loki on stage.
Sure.
And even, I guess, one of the big things that people were actually really kind of buzzing about was, even though Guardians of the Galaxy has only been shooting for 2 weeks, yeah, they brought a big chunk of the cast, and they actually brought a teaser trailer.
Ah.
And a lot of people said it was pretty freaking cool, and that Chris Pratt flipped the bird at the camera at one point. So this sounds very James Gunn-y to me, and I'm kind of excited. Yeah. James Gunn is still very adamant about how much he loves Rocket Raccoon, how he's his favorite character, and how he's going to be one of the main things. And he's like, and just the way he talks about it, I'm very excited for it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the panel, Kevin Figgy, that's not how you say it, but. They said it on the panel, right? But now I can't remember it, because all I can remember is how you say it, all funny and affected. Like. But anyway, yeah, I don't know why I'm ranting tonight really bad. However, he pretended like he was going to go off stage, and he came back on. He says, well, actually, there's one more thing Joss Whedon wants to tell everybody.
Okay, pause, sidebar. I like that at Comic-Con, panels have encores.
Yes.
Like you would a concert. Like, we want more reveals.
it's like that a lot anymore. Like, seriously, Comic-Con is like a big rock concert for film.
For nerds.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the comic book stuff, from what I understand, they're like these half-filled panel rooms that don't get filled up. So it's mostly for the media.
Sure.
The movie media and TV media stuff. But however, it is very exciting. Thank you. That was a big aside. Back to Joss Whedon coming on stage.
Yeah.
Joss Whedon comes on stage and he says, I don't really have much for you. Just wanted to tell you what the name of the movie is. And the movie is The Avengers, The Age of Ultron.
Now,
and then he left.
Tell us, Richard, who you know much more about comic books than I do, what is The Age of Ultron? What are we supposed to expect from this?
Well, already Age of Ultron, I mean, this is a really recent comic run. And
I don't know about it.
Exactly. It was, it's done, I think, in this last year. I know Bendis had a big part in it. But we already know Joss Whedon, like, right after he announced it, somebody interviewed him, and he was like, it doesn't have anything to tie in with this. It's going to be a Ultron, basically, we're going to do a... It's his own origin. It won't be tied to Hank Pym. Now, originally in the comic books, Hank Pym, this creator of enlarging and,
shrinking.
I guess, shrinking, yeah. I was going to say de-enlarging.
De-enlarging.
Yeah, I had my own version of that. But basically, he finds these things that he calls Pym particles, and they can make them big and small. This is Ant-Man. However, on his off time, I always thought this was kind of silly. In his off time, he was making androids, and he happened to make this android that didn't work out very well, but then gained sentient life and always attacked the Avengers and the Earth, deciding that humans were a weakness and they needed to be destroyed. And this always plagued Hank Pym because he was the creator and the father and so on and so forth.
Uh-huh.
But since we don't, we're not going into that. People are like, well, how are they going to set it up? Is Hank Pym going to be in the Avengers? Well, Joss Whedon got around to that, too, in the same interview, said, no, we're going to set it up completely aside from that. So, I mean, this brings up a lot of questions. Are they going to do the Vision? Are they going to, you know?
Well, wasn't it announced?
A lot of characters.
Wasn't it announced that, what's his ass? Vin Diesel, who was teased a little while ago as being talking to Marvel Studios, wasn't it announced that he was going to be Vision?
There's all sorts of rumors about him. Some people say he was going to be Hank Pym or O'Grady or whatever, or I forgot the other Ant-Man suddenly. There's three different... Everybody teased about those ones that he might be one of the Ant-Mans. Some people say he might be the voice of Rocket Raccoon. Some people say the Vision. Some people say Thanos. There are a lot of voice spots in Guardians of the Galaxy that do need to be filled.
Sure. Or that we know of, anyway.
That we know of.
So, you brought up the whole thing about Hank Pym building robots and one of them goes sentient. Not too far off from what they were doing in the Iron Man movies.
No, that was my thing. In Iron Man 2, I've said this since the day. I was like, you know, those very humanoid-looking droids in Iron Man 2 look very Ultron-y to me. And yeah. So when they come up with this, I was like, oh, yeah, that may actually, to me, Tony Stark or one of his villains or whatever being the father of, or a corrupted Jarvis being, you know, Ultron makes much more sense than this other, you know, this molecular biologist just going off on being like, well, hey, I think I'm going to experiment with androids this week. It makes this like death
machine
Android that can fight the whole Avengers team. So
okay, well, so I feel so, like I don't feel know. Like now I have a better handle on what this information means. I mean, people on my news feed on Facebook kept being like, Age of Ultron, WTF, and I was like, Age of Ultron, what's that?
Well, a lot of people, I mean, it is, I guess most people assume because they showed Thanos, but I guess again, like I said, I thought that there was going to be a bigger lead-up to him. I always thought that Thanos was kind of a strange villain to do in the second film because he's kind of a villain who destroys universes. Like, he's kind of a scary dude. So I was like, well, Joss Whedon wants to go more smaller, more intimate, and meaner, and, you know, maybe a little darker. That's what he said. So why would he go to Thanos next? Unless they're going to be like, Thanos is just going to come and just kill one of them and then leave. Which is always a possibility in a Joss Whedon film.
Yeah. Just at the very end, comes down and squishes Hawkeye and then just flies off. It's like, ha-ha, motherfuckers!
Yeah, that would be great.
And the credits.
Yeah, that's going to be at the end of Captain America 2. We predicted it here on the show. No, it makes a lot more sense for it to be Ultron. And I actually thought that at the end of Avengers, I was like, I don't think he's going to do Thanos next. I really don't. And so, I don't know. I'm kind of like, good. He's doing what I thought he was going to do. So.
All right. Well, that pretty much gets us caught up with everything there is to know coming out of Comic-Con that didn't have to do with television anyway.
Well, I don't know. There was a lot of crap.
Yeah, God knows there's probably more. Maybe once my roommate comes home from the convention and from California, I'll see if he can divulge anything I could discuss here. But little bit of extra news, little tidbit. We don't have to go into it a whole lot, but I just want to mention it. Actor Dennis Farina, who's probably most well known as a Law and Order guy. He was also mostly know him as a small part. It's not a small part, it's a pretty sizable part, from Get Shorty. He plays a gangster in it. He either played a gangster or a cop a lot. Actually, strangely, not too far off from the types of stuff that Gandolfini usually gets. Though he has...
I remembered him from Snatch.
Yeah, Snatch. He's well. He was in that as well. He just passed away recently from complications, medical complications. Actually, not as old as I would have thought. He was just 60. And you know, he's basically looked the same since 1994.
Right.
So yeah. I would have thought that he was probably closer to 70. But yeah, I don't know, kind of a bummer. A cool character actor who's kind of underused.
Yeah.
Because unfortunately, there hasn't been a lot of room for people his age unless they're going to play heavies.
Well, I think a lot of our big actors are starting to get that age, so they have to put them in red, too.
No, that's true. That's true.
Well, I guess moving on, unless you have more to say.
I don't.
Sacha Baron Cohen has dropped out of the Queen Freddie Mercury biopic.
Yeah, that actually really disappoints me. I looked at this article, and I was like, well, what happened? And I guess the discrepancy is that the remaining members of Queen have final say on all of this screenplay and all of the creative stuff in the movie. And they don't want to do a gritty, warts and all depiction of Freddie Mercury. They want it to be a PG-13. I guess they basically just want a big advertisement for Queen, you know? So they don't want to go into all of, like, the lurid, you know, sexual stuff that would come with a Freddie Mercury biopic.
Yeah, I heard they wanted it was going to be, like, a PG family film, even.
And because of it, Sasha dropped out. He said, I don't want to be in that movie. I want, you know, if we're going to do this, I want to do it for real. And I give him credit, because I think, I don't know what movie they want to make, and I hope that they work this all out and they're able to come to their senses and be like, listen, you know, I love Freddie Mercury as much as the next guy, and I like Queen a lot, and I really wanted to see this biopic, and that was such good casting, such interesting casting. But I don't want to go see a big, you know, Queen commercial about, you know, what we already know about them, which is that they were a rock band that did fairly well during the 70s and 80s. I want to see all that stuff about Freddie Mercury's personal life, because he kept it hidden for the most part. I mean, he was a fairly flamboyant stage presence, but, you know, it wasn't a time when he could really be out with that stuff, and he was one of our first big celebrities to die of AIDS in the early 90s.
Well, I think it's more, maybe some of his story might be a lot more relevant now also. And so I think, I personally believe that it would be. First of all, I mean, when you first see Sacha Baron Cohen in his movies, those kind of things, you're like, oh my gosh, he's that guy. But then when I saw him outside of those, and I saw him in other people's movies, the only thing I could think of is Hugo, but I knew he was in another big one.
He pops up every now and again, both in comedic. He hasn't done a ton of series. I mean, he was like in Sweeney Todd for a little bit, and he was also in, as a kind of comedic relief, he was in Les Mis. But there's something about him in this role that I'm just like, yes, it just clicks for me.
No, it works perfectly. I agree. And beyond that, I don't know. I was looking forward to it because I think he does have chops, like legitimate chops.
Yeah, and it would be great to see him have the platform to go for it.
Kind of stretch, right?
Yeah, and be able to carry a movie like that. And I think there is a ton of stuff you could say about Freddie Mercury now that you couldn't then, and it would be relevant in a different sort of way. You could frame that entire biopic in a really interesting way, but it seems like the remaining members of Queen have no interest in that.
Agreed.
And I actually think that that's the way Freddie would have wanted it.
I have no idea about that, but, like I said, I don't think, to me it seems very strange that they would want to make a family weirdo film about Queen.
Yeah.
Let's make a family film. I mean, it's not that bad, but are they going to make a family film of the Sex Pistols and like some of that? It's not the same.
Romantic comedy about Sid and Nancy.
Oh, very that kind of
starring Ashton Kutcher and Katherine Heigl.
I want to see that, actually.
Directed by Robert Luketic. yeah, no, I don't know, whatever.
I enjoy when you make fake bad films. I really do.
Well, you have to be careful nowadays. You can't make jokes like that because then they happen.
That's true. That's true.
All right. Well, we are going to review a movie this week. After we
review two.
Yeah, we are. We're going to review Only God Forgives, which you were able to see and I was not. And then later we'll be reviewing The Conjuring. But before we get to that, you have a pet topic.
I do have a pet topic. So this is kind of a weird topic to me, but I think it can kind of work out. What makes a pretentious movie in your eyes?
Okay. What do you mean exactly by pretentious? Is my definition of that part of the question you're asking?
Well, I think that does. Now we're getting into that kind of stuff again. what does this word mean? Let's get into the semantics. Specifically with pretentious, I kind of want it to be more of a personal thing because I think reviewing, I think you can only be so objective.
No, fair enough.
I think it's more your definition of pretentious because we could run into all sorts of problems if we did.
Well, you see the word pop up a lot, and I think the word has reached a point in which a moratorium needs to be placed on the word itself, because I think it's become... Before I even continue with this topic, I'm just going to say aloud once again, I am a huge fan of the Linoleum Knife podcast, and this topic has recently been discussed there, so I'm not ripping them off when I say, and I agree with what they said there, that on a critical standpoint, not necessarily filmgoers, but on a critical standpoint, the word has become a lazy shorthand. And it's a lot easier just to say something is pretentious and dismiss it than to actually give the movie a fair shot. Or even if it rubs you the wrong way or you find that it's being too highfalutin or that its ideas are only being approached but not really delved into or whatever you want to say is pretentious. It is a critic's job to unpack those problems rather than just stand 6 feet away from it and say, pretentious, and walk away.
It's as bad as saying, oh, that movie's stupid.
Yeah, well, why is it stupid? I don't like it.
Yeah, exactly.
But I do believe that it is a thing that can happen. And I don't use the word a lot in my reviews, specifically because I think it does kind of smell of a certain kind of cine immaturity. That's what I was trying to say. But I did use the word, and I felt like it was well-placed for when I saw the movie The Words last year. Okay. And the reason...
Well, I think I remember you explaining, though, because you said pretentious, then you said it was so far... You went into detail about how it was so far up its own ass.
Yeah.
I remember that.
And that's generally... When I see a movie that I would describe as pretentious, another film that comes to mind is Zack Snyder's Sucker Punch.
Okay.
Even though I think ultimately he was just trying to make a big flashy popcorn film, he tried to wrap it up in this narrative puzzle boxy film within a film within a film, dream within a dream. You know, is it real? Is it not real? Is it, you know, Inception for the World of Warcraft set? And ultimately it's like, I don't care because you don't care. And if you don't care about all of this narrative tilt-a-whirling you're doing, then why then why should I try and unpack something where there's not a whole lot to unpack, even if you're doing that? And that's where I came with the words. It was like, okay, I understand you really think this movie is highfalutin and interesting and topical and full of ideas, but it really isn't. And when I see that within the first 15 minutes and the movie keeps going for another hour and a half, that's when I get the whiff of pretentiousness.
Right.
When the movie thinks it's smarter than it actually is.
See, I think a film can be artfully pretentious, where it tries to be way too much, like, tries to say too much, but really isn't saying it at all, because it's all just style and no substance.
Sure.
That's basically what
I'm saying.
Yeah, I think it really depends. I didn't know I was being so topical, first off. So I guess yay for me for going along with Linoleum Knife. But specifically, no, this is a word that I do see pop up often. And specifically, after I saw Only God Forgives, I ran into a small review in the troll boxes beneath articles. In one of those boxes happened to be somebody who called it pretentious. He kind of went into it a little bit.
Sure.
So I'll give him credit for that. But specifically, it kind of made me start thinking about it. Well, okay, well, what is so pretentious about this? And at first I was like, well, I think it's just, you know, with my own personal read of the movie, I was like, I think it's just this. And I don't think it's that pretentious at all. I think you just have to be more, you know, you have to be less cynic and mature. You have to have a certain vocabulary or certain vernacular in film.
Well, and you have to be willing to give a movie. And I think
then I read an article by Refn talking about parts of it. And I was like, I didn't get any of that from that. Maybe you are up your own ass. I think a filmmaker does have to be up his own ass a little bit sometimes to make an art film. I really do.
I mean,
at least a little bit.
I think, that goes into a whole separate thing, which is when a filmmaker makes a film, he might be, in his head, be making a different film than what he's actually making. And I think one of the jobs of a critic, mm-hmm. and why they are a necessary part of the world of filmmaking in general, is to be able to make the distinction of what was intended to be made and what actually was made. And maybe in some cases, what actually was made is better than what the filmmaker thought he was making. Or, you know, and I mean, we have talked a lot about, like, subtext and those kind of things, and I don't always think that subtext is intentional. I think sometimes a lot of that stuff is either subconsciously put in the film by the filmmaker without realizing what they're doing,
most of the time it is.
Based on social conventions that they're not even aware of, or, going in line with a
particular philosophy or...
Sure, or a strain of filmmaking tradition that they don't even, that they're not even aware that they're part of.
I think that can happen, yeah.
So a lot of times when you're reading directors talking about their own work, it's not uncommon for there to be a disconnect between what you saw and what you thought of and what the director says. A lot of times I actually don't like listening or to a director talk about their own work unless they're really, they're really self-conscious about their own work in a positive way. Like, I think Tarantino talks about his work pretty honestly because I think he's his own biggest fan. So he's able to he has a weird detachment from his own work where he can actually kind of dissect it in a way that's actually interesting to listen to. But
he's also, he actually believes in the film criticism, too.
No, yeah.
He's not one of those fuck critics. They don't have anything to say.
No, yeah, he reads everything. He reads all of his negative reviews, too, whether or not he agrees with it, which is there's something to be said about that. But also, I think, you know, a filmmaker like Refn, or a lot of European directors especially, they're kind of more just working from a tonal foundation or a mood or an idea rather than, you know, and then they build the genre stuff up from there. Yeah. And that's kind of the opposite of how American filmmaking works. American filmmaking works is they have the genre, they have the cast, they have the framework. You know, a producer like Bruckheimer or someone says, Lone Ranger, the movie! And then somebody has to make that movie.
And they find writers, and then they go for it.
Yeah, right? And then all of that stuff can work its way in from the top down. So when you hear a European director talk about their film, a lot of times they'll be talking about the emotions and the moods and, you know, the day that they were in the flower shop and a woman gave them a strange look and it made them get this idea of how the car was going to be painted a certain way.
No, right. You get this really strange, like... No, I like actually watching some of those crazy directors.
Sure.
Like Lynch.
Yeah.
Because sometimes you're like, where the fuck is this guy from? He's not even talking about his own film. I know he's not. He says he is, but I know he's not. What is he talking about? So, I don't know.
Yeah, there's certain directors you can't really take for what they say about their own work seriously. And I think, you know, Lynch is one of those guys. I think he purposely likes to be vague. And I think Refn is one of those guys, too, because... I think the critics do a good enough job at unpacking all that stuff that it shouldn't be the filmmaker's responsibility to explain the work. Unfortunately, we live in a media-intensified world where they have to, and some are better at it than others. The ones that are a little bit more sober, and I don't mean that necessarily in a drug and alcohol sense, but just, you know, their feet are on the ground,
right.
They can... talk about their own work. I think Soderbergh's actually really good about talking about his own work in a realistic and grounded way where he's talking to human beings about human beings. But
David Fincher probably as well.
Yeah, Fincher is really good at it. But there are a lot who are, you know, they want to see their filmmaking as something other than explainable, and they purposely don't want to unpack all that stuff because it's kind of like having to explain a joke. It kind of doesn't make it funny anymore. So if you're a filmmaker and you have to explain what your work means. And as an artist, and I use that word really fucking lightly, I kind of know what that's like. When I was in art school and we would have to put our stuff on the wall, sometimes if it was a work that was not all that personal, I could go into it. But a lot of times when it, you know, if it was something that was more idea or mood based, and then I had to try and unpack that in front of the whole class, either it was too embarrassing to go into or I felt like I don't want to explain the work because I'm actually more interested in what you'll say about it.
Fair enough. Well, I also appreciate some of the directors who kind of step back and say, well, what do you think? Because, I mean, when it comes down to it, the person that's interpreting the work is just as important as the person who made the work because...
Right.
Because they're not going to be there. I mean, if you know these top-tier directors and you can ask them, that's cool for you, but... the most of us don't get that opportunity. I think that's a good enough place to kind of go into my review of Only God Forgives.
Okay. And I'm actually going to listen to this because it's too hard to try and edit around it when I don't. So go ahead.
I think that's fair, but also I don't feel like this is a movie. I think the synopsis pretty much tells you what the story is. Uh-huh. But it's not one of those movies you can really spoil.
Sure.
It's not like, oh, no, a plot point. Basically, this to me was a Kung Fu film.
Okay.
Wrapped in a David Lynch film.
Sure. And I kind of got that from the trailer.
Yeah. I did not watch many of the trailers, or I didn't try to go into it very much at all because I kind of wanted to be surprised by weirdness. And yeah. I was. This is very much a David Lynch meets Kung Fu film, as I was saying. So the basic synopsis, it's a revenge tale with Ryan Gosling, who plays kind of a sleazy guy, and his brother, who's even a sleazier guy, does something and gets killed while doing it, and a cop comes after him in a sort of fashion for revenge. It's kind of a revenge flick, kind of a Kung Fu movie, kind of a David Lynch movie, kind of, and definitely a Refn movie. The David Lynchian elements, specifically some of the, he does some of those quiet, still, weird moments and sure. kind of surreal moments like a David Lynch film. And yeah. then beyond that, he really does a stilted or strange, portrayal with his actors that I haven't seen in his other films. Most of his other films have been very naturalistic to me, or at least.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call Drive naturalistic.
No, that one's very stylistic. But I would say that he stilted his actors in the way that he did that David Lynch does. Okay. Whereas in this film, very much so. Not just Ryan Gosling, but also Kristin Scott Thomas, okay. who plays Ryan Gosling's mother at one point. She comes into it. She is very much a kind of somewhere between like Laura Dern and Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet almost.
Okay.
I think this kind of fits in with his, you know, I think Drive to me was, at least to me, was Taxi Driver mixed with a John Hughes film. Whereas Bronson was a crime film mixed with...
Clockwork Orange.
Clockwork Orange. So, I mean, in a way, a lot of his films are almost taking on these prolific directors.
Yeah.
And kind of doing them, and I would say doing them quite successfully.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not necessarily a huge Lynch fan, but I did appreciate this movie. It was very violent, that's for sure. Now, this is my review as in what would I recommend to people? What I would recommend, essentially, is if you're into David Lynch films and you're into weird art films, please go see this. Now, if you're a Hey Girl Ryan Gosling fan, please don't go see this. You're just going to be annoying. you're going to be annoying, and you're not going to enjoy the film. You're not going to have the vernacular to enjoy the film.
Wow. Well, what about, I don't know, I mean, how many of movies do the Hey Girl Ryan Gosling crowd really get, though? Because Ryan Gosling, for the most part, has been working against his type for most of his career.
I don't know. You know, this film specifically...
Every once in a while, you get a Crazy Stupid Love in there. But most of the time, if you like Ryan Gosling, you got to put up with the movies he's in. And I mean that in a good way.
No, I do too. I like Ryan Gosling a lot. And I think he's pretty decent in this. Uh-huh. He has less dialogue than in Drive. He looks at the camera with brooding a lot more for most of the film. In fact, that's one thing I would say is I almost kind of feel like he was underutilized a little, but...
Okay.
How's
the violence? Because there was a lot of talk coming out of Cannes.
Oh, shit, the violence. It's brutal and rough. Does the violence have a place? Yes. Refn always uses the violence as either kind of driving it, or he uses it to symbolize things. In this film, it's very symbolic. There's a lot of sexual. He mixes sex and violence in this a lot.
Okay.
And specifically in this one, where it's mixed, is there's a lot of demasculation, kind of symbolisms towards that. And I would say this film is a lot more about demasculation of character and a lot more what manliness is and that kind of thing than it is anything else. where I got my pretentious questions specifically, Refn said that this was about a man trying to find God. And I was like, okay, I didn't get that at all from it, but I guess you are demasculated by God. Cool. I found it a strange, what was strange and interesting about this film is though the lead character, Ryan Gosling, spoke very, very little, you learn so much about that character, about how people talked to him and how people treated and reacted towards him.
Yeah. Well, which was pretty similar to how his character was treated in Drive.
Yeah, but in Drive, he was just a super badass. Like, I mean, they don't really go into him. He is kind of, it is almost kind of when Refn said it was almost kind of a superhero film, I was like, kind of in a way, yeah. But in this film, it's not like that. It's a very different film. It's a smaller budget, but that isn't necessarily a bad thing. I thought a lot of the Asian cast does very well. There's lots of torture and blood, and it's a rough film. It's an interesting film, but very rough.
Did you find it boring? Because I've heard some of the complaints of the movie is that it's boring.
I found it interesting for the most part. It's slow.
Yeah.
It's definitely deliberate, but to me, he says, I forgot who he quoted as the director, that he said it was kind of influenced by. The only thing I could think was Blue Velvet and Mulholland Drive. That's the only thing I could think almost the whole time. Okay. He's very deliberate with his colors. He's very deliberate with his cast. I think he got performance out of them that were very much like a Lynch film.
So that they're kind of playing... They're caricatures that they're playing, kind of these larger than life, not supposed to be taken as grounded or literal, but exactly. More metaphorical characters.
Yes, very much so.
Okay, you've sold it for me. I mean, I wanted to see this movie already. I could kind of get that was the vibe from the trailer. Sure. He's a huge Lynch fan. I mean, one of his earlier films that we watched together, Fear X, was kind of. I think he was still trying to figure out his influences at that point. It's not a great film, but it's definitely Lynchian in a big way.
I think this did remind me of that movie, but this was more successful and definitely more Lynchian. This isn't by far my favorite of his films, but it was interesting. And, I don't know. I don't find a whole lot to it, but it is an interesting take.
Okay. Well, cool. Well, I'll try and see it as soon as I can. You know, soon I will be living in California, so I'll actually be in a place where I can watch it before it's on DVD. Well, the next film we're going to talk about is a film that we were both able to see this weekend, which opened wide. And that is James Wan's The Conjuring, James Wan being the director of the original Saw movie, as well as Dead Silence and Insidious. And he'll be doing Insidious 2 here shortly. This is a ghost haunted house possession thriller not too far off from Insidious, actually, except for I think this is quite a bit better. The basic story is that there is this family that moves into a really old house, and it's a period piece. It takes place in the, I want to say, early 70s. And the parents of the family is played by Ron Livingston and Lily Taylor. Ron Livingston of the Office Space fame, and Lily Taylor, I mean, that's what he's from.
Fair enough.
That's what most people will know him from. And Lily Taylor, who was in a really bad haunted house movie a long time ago, the remake of The Haunting. And weird things start to happen. They discover a basement full of weird, strange trinkets, and they start to hear things, they start to see things, they start to experience all this strange sensory things like weird smells, of course, the temperature going down, your ghost movie tropes. And as these things start to escalate and animals, some of which were their pets, start to die, they decide to get in contact with some paranormal researchers, Vera Farmiga and Patrick Wilson playing Ed and Lorraine Warren, two real-life paranormal researchers who actually did speak at ISU, apparently, a few years ago. They're kind of paranormal researchers slash demonologists, slash ghost hunters, whatever you want to call them. And they decide to kind of take on, even though they're kind of getting to a point in their career where they sort of want to take a break because they've ran into some pretty hairy stuff that's left them traumatized. Specifically Vera Farmiga, who's something of a medium. They decide to take this one on. And they get it very involved in this case, and they get very involved in sort of the family structure and the family dynamics because they have a daughter of their own. And what this movie does really interestingly, and how why I think it succeeds much more than the usual haunted house thriller, in which there are, you know, about 12 a year now. This is done by the Paranormal Research, or the Paranormal Activity production crew, who have been putting out all of these movies. What I think this one does really successfully is it makes the paranormal researchers just as much of characters as the family. They don't just come in to expose exposition and, you know, then they walk out and some more stuff happens and they come back and see, but this is what's happening. They're actually characters, and the story, in a way, is more about their arc than the family. And it's framed really interestingly with a prologue involving a creepy doll. And it kind of does a lot of old horror movie stuff, but it does it in a really classic and smart and stylish and terrifying. I mean, this is one of the scariest movies I've seen in a long time.
Agreed.
I mean, not just kind of creepy, as in most of these movies usually are. It's like, that was creepy. I mean, I
want to get into the audience reaction, because I found that very interesting in my situation. I noticed it.
Okay. Go for it.
I agree with pretty much, I'll probably add on my own two cents for sure, because I love horror movies. But
as do I.
You're right. This is a great movie.
Yeah,
you know,
this isn't just
and surprisingly so.
Yeah,
but this worked. I found a lot of similitudes to like The Exorcist in this film. But however, the audience reaction to this was fascinating. I walked into an audience that was very much your typical, I'm coming to see a shitty horror, I'm going to make jokes, and I'm a funny guy.
Yeah,
that's the audience that I walked into.
Sure.
This is what you got. At the first, so they're making jokes, they're talking a lot, girls are, you know, being, ooh, this is going to be creepy, this is what ended up happening. Halfway through the film, those jokesters started to make, like, their jokes seemed to be kind of funny, because these jokes started to end up kind of being, like, ways to relieve tension.
Yeah.
And that's what happened midway through the film. They were kind of like clapping and doing some other things.
Yeah.
And trying to be funny. What happened at the last third of the film? Dead silence. Mm-hmm. I have not been in an audience. I don't think I've been in an audience that's been so chatty and jokey and everything through like that at the very start. And then at the end being dead silence like that. This affected people. And I liked looking at them as they went out and they were scared. And it was great. the other thing that I loved about this film, and why I think it's got such a similitude to the Exorcism movie, the original William Friedkin film, uh-huh. is, as you said, it established your exorcists, and they became real characters. But the other thing it gave you, even though you may believe or may not believe in these kind of supernatural occurrences,
yeah.
in the film they built a world you would believe in.
Yeah.
And that they set you rules, but they did it in such a great... I mean, this does feel like a movie from the 70s.
It does.
It was creepy as shit, and they mix elements from like our more modern ways of telling stories, and it all worked.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was kind of blown away, really.
I was too. I came out of the movie.
I was expecting something kind of crude. Sorry, that was ridiculous.
Oh, no,
do you want? Should we start to try to talk at the same time and maybe say almost the same thing again?
Go ahead and say what you're going to say.
Okay. No, this film, I wasn't expecting it. Beyond surprising me, to me, this is going to be one of those films that you put with the other classic horror movies that you love.
Yeah.
Besides that, going into the exorcism and kind of the witchcraft and everything that they mixed into the plot,
yeah.
I just found it all, even though it could all be tropish and kind of silly, they made it work in a real way that really ground it down. You got real performances from kids like I've almost never seen.
Joey King, who was the little voice in Oz the Great and Powerful, and I believe she's in another movie coming out here shortly. She's incredible in this movie.
Agreed. Vera Farmiga, Patrick Wilson, of course, they're always good.
Yeah.
All the actors did good. Well, Ron Livingston was maybe the most odd man out, but even he did pretty well.
I think he did really well with what he had. I don't think that the movie's as interested in him.
No.
But I think that he's... I think even just padding a character like that that could be basically played by anybody and getting a character that... I think people an actor that basically everybody likes, brings more to it.
He does have a face that just kind of like makes you go, he is a good guy.
Yeah.
But even like, I was even thinking about that, the cop, like random cop dude who all of a sudden is part of the film.
Sure.
Right. You got a real sense from him even. And he was in the film for maybe 15 minutes, you know, 15, 20 minutes, maybe at most.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the setups, too, you know, they'll set something up, and then they'll bring it up, and it'll be very ferocious in your face. Everything tied together well. This is a great movie. I think if you're a horror fan, you should go see this. I think if you're not a horror fan, you should go see this, and then maybe you'll never see a horror movie again for a few years.
Yeah.
But you'll entertain people like me, who part of their joy is to see other people kind of get spooked out.
Yeah,
I got freaked out a little bit. It was good.
Yeah, no, I've been having trouble sleeping. I'm not gonna lie. I mean, this, and you know, Keith's gone. I'm here by myself. No,
there's a witch in your basement.
Let's not hope. What's incredible about this movie is that I was so over this kind of movie. You know, I mean, there's every, like, 3 months, there's another one of these movies, another one of these haunted house bad place stories, and they're all basically the same. And this one isn't necessarily not just like those movies. It follows very similar tropes as all of them. But it just does it so well. It's all in the execution. James Wan is an incredible director when he wants to be.
To give him his credit, he did the first Saw movie, one of his first films, and it's the best one.
And he's incredible.
The rest of them suck.
He was very, very young when he made it, too.
Great. Insidious is pretty good. I think there were parts that didn't deliver, and I thought there were tonal problems more than directional problems.
Sure.
Which, I mean, that's kind of a directional problem, but specifically his shots were good, his palette, everything like that. Everything was pretty good. He just kind of lost me towards the end.
Mm-hmm.
However, this film, from start to go, was just, wow. He made a damn fine film.
Agreed. And the next film he's going to be making is Fast and the Furious 7.
Yeah, right?
So we'll see how that happens there. I definitely recommend this movie, and I think it's likely to be the best horror movie of the year, and one of the scariest horror movies, at least since Sinister, which actually I think this is better.
I haven't seen Sinister yet, but this film, I don't know.
Sinister got me, despite how dumb its premise was, but everything here is good.
Yeah.
Okay, so there you go. That's our episode. We're not going to be able to do our Netflix homework, as we already stated. We'll hold that until next week, but I think we've already ran over time anyway.
Yeah, probably. We usually do.
Which is usually our forte.
That's our calling card.
That's our calling card.
Well, I mean, our podcast name is Jabber and the Drone.
Yeah.
So Jabber and Drone on, come on.
We call it that for a reason. But anyway, if you want to get in contact with us, or if you have anything you want to say about any of the movies we talked about this week, any of those crazy reveals from Comic-Con, or anything about Only God Forgives or The Conjuring, you can get in contact to us through jabberandthedrone@gmail.com, which is our which is our email address.
Are you about to give my personal email address out?
Yeah, you know, I want your identity thieved as well. You can also get in contact to us through our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/jabberpodcast. Like us there, and you can see anytime we post news items between episodes, some that we talk about on the show, some that we don't. You can also suggest different Netflix homeworks that we may have not talked about in previous episodes. You can subscribe to us on iTunes, and if you do, please write us a review. Anything, it doesn't have to be much. Give us a star rating and a sentence or two about how you like the show. You can also stream us at our Podbean webpage, which is jabberandthedrone.podbean.com. You can just click stream and listen to us from your office if that's how you like to do it. You can also find our RSS feed there, too, if you want to subscribe using a different method than iTunes. You can read all of my weekly reviews that I do for the Idaho State Journal and the monthly reviews that I do for the Basic Alternative at saladforkreviews.blogspot.com, as well as the jhub.com/reviews. You can see my movie columns that I write for the Seattle-based podcast, the MacGuffinPodcast.com. I have some content there under the authors, Cassidy Robinson. And you can find Richard having a surreal sword battle with Ryan Gosling in a well-lit room. How do you like
that? If I had to be one of the characters, I would rather not be Ryan Gosling. Really. So you picked the right character.
Okay. Otherwise, we'll talk to you later.
Okay, bye.
Bye.